Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the March 19, 2017 session, focusing on Romans chapter 5, verses 1 through 11, non-reactionary love. I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm Aaron Hall.
I'm David Adams.
We're glad to have Aaron and David with us tonight. They've both been with us in the past, but just in case you've missed them, Aaron is a writer, mother to Logan, and a doctoral student at Columbia Seminary. You can follow her at her blog at aaronrobinsonhall.com. And most importantly, she is the co-host of a podcast called Glass Half Full that she does with our very own Nikki Hardiman. Welcome back, Aaron.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Glad you're here. And then David is also a returning guest. He regularly teaches at the Baptist Seminary of Kentucky. I think you've got a course going right now, don't you, David?
Oh, yes.
Yes. And he is what we call our chief curriculum guru at Faith Element, which means he edits the six flavors of session pages that we offer each week. Glad you're back, David.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Now, Daniel actually can't be with us tonight, but he was kind enough to record an intro to this text to help us get started. And so through the magic of podcasting, we're going to have Daniel with us just for a bit, and then we'll take over the conversation from there. So thanks, Daniel, for helping us out with this.
Sure, David, I'll be glad to. But in an effort to introduce this section of Romans, perhaps we need to look back and see where we began. In the very first chapter of Romans, Paul paints a very dark picture of the world. Full of envy, he says, murder, strife, deceit, craftiness, gossipers, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, haughty, boastful, rebellious toward parents, heartless, faithless, ruthless. They know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die. Paul paints a dark picture indeed. It reminds me of the haunting book by Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel entitled Night. We've talked about that book before. Our listeners will remember. But Wiesel writes, "Never shall I forget that night, the first night in camp which has turned my life into one long night. Seven times cursed and seven times sealed. Never shall I forget the little faces of the children whose bodies I saw turned into wreaths of smoke beneath the silent blue sky. Never shall I forget those moments which murdered my God and my soul and turned my dreams to dust. Never shall I forget these things, even if I am condemned to live as long as God Himself." Like Paul, Elie Wiesel paints a very dark picture of the world. But before we climb upon our high horses, being proud that we are not part of all that darkness, Paul stops our finger-pointing in chapter 2. At whatever point, Paul says, you judge others, you are really condemning yourself, because you who pass judgment do these very same things. Paul's right, there's darkness inside us all. He continues this theme in chapter 3. There is no distinction, Paul says famously, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Having thoroughly made his point, Paul says, we talked about this 2 weeks ago, sin abounds, but so does grace. I emphasized that because I love that word, but. I'm talking about the three-letter contraction, not the body part, get your heads out of the gutter. But most of us use the word negatively. But I'm not good enough. But I'm not ordained. But I haven't gotten my life straight yet. But I'm only a child. Yet God, we might say, turns our butts around. Okay, that part was a joke. But that little word, but, is used over 5,000 times in Scripture. Not as a word of excuse, but to speak of something new, unexpected, marvelous. But announces the grace that turns our lives around. Yes, the world is in a rough place. Yes, we still fail to love our neighbors as ourselves. Yes, there is still sin in this world. But, Paul says, God proves His love for us, that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Such incredible, undeserving, yet beautiful love. That's a little background on our text for today.
And again, we're talking about this sense of darkness, two pieces of that. One is every generation thinks their days are the darkest days of all time and has stories to tell about why those are such dark days. The other is sometimes darkness is predicated on how we feel about the times we're in. It's our own perspective on the times rather than the times themselves. So if you're a child and you just got spanked for something, it's the darkest day of your life. This is half the big scheme of things. It's not really that dark. You experience a bit of personal darkness as a growth opportunity, maybe, but it's not the darkest days of all time.
I think you're 100% right. And my 4-year-old flung himself on the floor on Sunday and said, "You're breaking my heart and you're the worst," because I made a sweater vest to church on Sunday.
Well, then you were.
Yeah.
That is the worst. I hated sweater vests.
Well, he thought the world was over.
They're scratchy.
Yeah.
The sweater vest. I mean, you don't have to explain any more than that.
Oh, Aaron, you're such a better mom than me. I think Liam went to church last Sunday with holes in his pants.
Well, the rule is I get to pick the clothes on Sunday.
You pick
the clothes any other day, but I pick on Sunday because I wanted to be cute. And I win as long as he's 4. But, you know, I do think you're right that suffering is a little bit more than maybe just our perspective.
Well, would you say that there are times in history that are darker than others?
Well, yes.
Depends on who you are. I think you can't judge suffering in terms of a universal. You have to judge it relative to what you know and what you personally experience. And with the understanding that God is above and beyond us and can see the whole sweep of history, but we can't.
I mean, I think absolutely, like, we suffer less than our ancestors. We have better medical help, so less women die in childbirth. Now, certainly when you go to different parts of the world, those numbers fluctuate. But if you're looking at the history of the world overall, we do better there. People are less violent than they used to be, even though it doesn't feel like us feel like that today, because right now things feel a lot more violent to us, I think, than maybe they have in a long time. But relative to the history of the world, things probably are a lot less violent than they used to be.
No, but I think where you're going with that, I mean, think about this. One of the things, and yes, I'll get political here, but when people talk about what they're most afraid of in our country, and they look at the rise of a potential totalitarian state, or even use words like, they throw around words like Nazi and fascist and things like that as if it's some big threat. Well, my parents lived in a time when there really were Nazis and fascists out there. They had to be fought, and people gave up their lives to protect us from that. You know, those were dark times. What we have now is more like we're complaining about something that's not the way we like it, but it isn't the same, even though it looks dark to us.
Although I wonder, you know, for immigrant families, I mean,
sure,
it's a pretty scary time right now. Parents and children being separated, that's a scary, dark thing.
Yeah, and it gives you the ability to say, you know, I'm looking at my life now and I'm feeling like I have it tough, but if I just lift up my head for a second and see what everybody else goes through, my suffering isn't that bad by comparison. It's not quite that dark.
Yeah, I read an article yesterday that said that psychologists have coined a new term because of the Syrian refugee children. And it's called human devastation syndrome.
What is that?
So it's children who have gone through this Syrian refugee situation. You have families that are 9 or 10 strong before, and 1 or 2 survive, you know, and they regularly see dismembered bodies that used to be their family, and they have experienced so much devastation and trauma. That it's a whole new category of things to deal with. I'm like, we have the Syrian refugee situation has created a new syndrome because it is beyond what anybody has seen or experienced before.
Well, this century.
In this century, absolutely. I mean, sure.
So you're saying we have a new term to understand this new level
what these children are facing.
Like we've never faced before.
Mm-mm. Well, like David said, in this century, because certainly people have faced that before, but the way most of us listening to or creating this podcast suffer is tiny. compared to what other people suffer. And at the same time, whatever it is we face, because most of us have also faced really hard things. We've lost someone very, very close to us, or we have struggled with mental illness or infertility or whatever it is that we have dealt with, and all of those things, to lessen their impact by saying, well, it's not as bad as fill in the blank. It's not, that might be true, right? But I don't know that it's helpful to say it, because the worst thing anybody has ever faced is the worst thing they've faced.
Yeah.
And so learning to live and cope with that is something we all have to do, whatever that worst thing is for us.
I was talking to a friend today about this very thing. As much as, like, I don't think we understand suffering on the level that some people in the world are actually suffering. I mean, I have not experienced human devastation syndrome.
Right.
And neither has my friend, but she was very upset. She got some news about one of her children, a diagnosis. And she said, people try to comfort me by saying at least, and then fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. And I said, pretty much anything that starts with the word at least is to comfort that person. They're not trying to comfort you. They're dismissing your pain and suffering. And so I do think that all of us, I mean, we may not have had human devastation, like what you were describing, but we've had pain. And it makes me think, how does hope work in that kind of pain? It may not have been the pain of the whole world, but it's still painful.
It's painful to us at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And really at the end, all we can work with is what we know and we've experienced. Everything else we've just read about.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think that what Paul is saying, and at least the way that I read it, is that our suffering can be the way we make it to hope. I think the way I read it is that eventually, if we allow suffering to not devastate us, and saying that is tenuous, right? Because that assumes that if someone is devastated by the suffering that they face, that it's their fault. And that's not what I intend or mean at all. But that if we are able to endure the suffering and allow it to shape us in positive ways, that it can be a window into hope. And I don't think that means denying the suffering or pretending like it doesn't exist.
Well, to the people who Paul was writing, they very much understood that the things you do bring suffering upon you. It is your fault, or it's your parents' fault. They pass it down genetically to you.
Sure, sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was dealing with people who felt that. And I think in some of their, this is the element that they had it coming. You know, when we talk about all these people with these bad habits, or these evil God haters, insolent, haughty people, things of that nature, there's this sense of, okay, this is karma getting back at you. There's also hope for the people who, you know, by no fault of their own, they're involved in something. It's not good, and they're suffering. To both of these people, you know, Christ offered a way out, a way to grow, a way to have something better and to grow closer to God and not have to wallow in and be condemned to suffering. I think Paul kind of speaks to both of them here. Well, he directly speaks to both of them, even with the line, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us, speaks directly to that.
Which I think is a really beautiful word of hope, especially like, because with your commentary, David, that he was speaking to an audience who felt like they were condemned to the suffering that they faced, right? That
yes.
If they're suffering in a certain way, it's the fault of them or their parents, and that they were stuck with it. And then Paul came in and said, I know you're suffering, and that doesn't have to be the end of the story.
It's not the end. I love the word produce here, like something's being created out of each of those things.
Mm, talk more about that.
Well, character produces hope. You know, suffering produces endurance. It's not the end of there. Something else is being created out of it.
But we don't have, our suffering doesn't have to produce growth, does it? I mean, suffering, I mean, some of it has to do with how we ultimately approach our suffering, would you say?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, okay, I'm thinking about, I have a relative who years ago fought overseas in a war. Mm-hmm. And before that time, he was, he was a person of faith and believed. But that experience, that was a dark, hard experience. I don't even know the things he must have seen, and he wouldn't talk about it. Hmm. But when he came back, he would not have anything to do with the church or faith. And so, you know, I was thinking he suffered terribly, but it did not, at least in that case, seem to produce, it didn't seem to turn into something that helped his faith grow. Instead, it was the opposite. And I think that can happen, right?
And it's a potential that's created. It doesn't have to be a realized potential. Mm-hmm. Potentially, it can be turned to that, but you kind of have the element of choice in that. You can go either way with it. And sometimes it doesn't appear like you have a choice, but I think something a lot of us are beginning to realize, and you'll hear this said more in theological circles, especially as postmodernism kicks in, this idea that faith is really a process of making a choice, basically every day, of what you're going to follow and where you stand and why you stand there. And as we get more and more information, we have every reason in the world not to choose faith and not to let our suffering shape us in a good direction. Every reason. We have people who publish things every day that tell us this, but we still, knowing that, make that choice. And in making that choice on a continuous basis, we demonstrate a faith.
Because I think you're right. I mean, and just even what Daniel was telling us, you know, out of the first chapter of Romans, that Paul paints a dark picture of the world full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, craftiness, sure, slanderers, God haters, blah, blah, blah. I mean, but the world's like that, right?
Absolutely.
And
it's Paul's picture.
Yeah.
I wonder if, I'm intrigued by what you said, David, about your relative. I mean, I don't know your relative at all. But you said that, you know, when he returned, he had nothing to do with the church. And it seemed like, you know, what he experienced had, you know, didn't do anything to help his faith grow or him to grow in hope and that kind of thing. And that may be absolutely true for him. And I don't know that, and this might be suspect, but I don't know that choosing to have nothing to do with the church is a sign that you haven't grown. And so what I mean by that is that when we grow from our suffering, I think what it really means is that we can see the world the way that it really is. Like, because before we have suffered, I think about my kids. I mean, they'll tell you they suffer every day, but the truth of the matter is they've never really suffered, right? And they still believe in Santa Claus. They see the world through the rose-colored glasses of children. Natalie, my oldest, is getting to the point where she's experiencing that loss of innocence because a friend has hurt a feeling or she's been betrayed by someone at school. You know, those, and so she's experienced the way that humans can hurt one another at a kid level, like a fourth grade level, mm-hmm. Which is starting to get pretty rough a little bit. So she's starting to have that loss of innocence. I'm wondering if that's part of what, or connects to at least what Paul's talking about, that suffering gives us a new picture of the world that we did not have before we suffered. I've talked on this podcast before about the loss of my second child. And so sometimes when I'm invited to places to speak about that, I'll say that after that, after that happened to me, all of a sudden, I lived in a world where babies died for real. Like, I had read about them on the news, but it had not happened to me. And so now my world changed. I lived in a world that I view differently. And that's hard. Like, that's not easy. That's not pretty. That's not fun. It's not light. But it doesn't mean that I can't find hope, right? That I can't be transformed by that experience in a way that makes me more whole, that makes my hope more realistic, and maybe even more tenacious. Like, by golly, I am going to hope for the good in the world in spite of the bad that I've seen or the pain that I've experienced. So I'm curious to think about what we mean by growth and hope, because sometimes I think when people suffer, they can look harder on the outside, but really they've kind of grown on the inside. I don't know.
That's what I hear you saying. Like, you talked about when your world changed, that you changed.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I changed completely. I mean, in lots of ways, not in every way, but yeah, I mean, I viewed the world differently.
And so transformation is what we're talking about. And so suffering is maybe the person is not changing. Their view of the world is not changing. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. No, I think suffering can be transformative one way or another. Like David Adams said that it's a potential for growth, but you don't have to realize it. It could be, you could be transformed, because we all know people who've had terrible things happen to them and they become terrible, horrible people in the world. Mm-hmm. They become hateful and mean, bitter. Yeah, bitter. Absolutely. And they just want to share that with the world. They just want to put more bitterness out there. Like, so that, I think that suffering can transform one way or another.
Now, possibly when we talk about suffering, we might mean a lot more by suffering than the term actually means here.
Mm.
When we say suffering, it's blown some big, catastrophic, awful thing that's happened to somebody that everyone would agree, oh, this was very bad. But maybe when we look at this passage, that's not the totality of what is being meant by suffering here. Maybe it's that event that jars your world and says things aren't the way that you wish they would be and they could never be there. Something's broken. You know, the world didn't work the way I expected it to, and now I feel bad because I'm suffering through this broken world. But there are different levels of broken for different people.
Mm-hmm.
David, do you remember it was a Seymour and that did a book that talked about how experiences in life can cause us to, they talked about it with the experiences in life, especially hard ones, could cause our, what they call temple of meaning to crumble. Do you remember the book I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. I remember, but I don't remember the name.
I remember this idea.
Yeah, I'll have to look it up. And share it. The idea is that we, like I've heard different ones of you explaining, you know, as we're moving through life, we tend to have this picture of how things work. This is how things are. This is how things are not. This is how things work. This causes this and this causes that. And we tend to build what they described as temples of meaning, the way we make meaning out of experience in the world. And then something terrible comes along and it doesn't work anymore. What used to make sense out of things doesn't make sense anymore. And so that temple gets shattered. And what they argued was, and these were anthropologists, they were, you know, doing ethnographic studies. And what they said was that some people, that was a point at which the temple got rebuilt, but it got built stronger. Mm-hmm. It was a wiser temple of meaning that was able to accommodate this different world that they didn't understand or know before. Whereas others, it might just lay there in ruins. There was not this effort to rebuild that. It was rather that didn't work, so it's gone. And I guess I hear that same kind of choice maybe is part of our choice of faith every day.
Right. It's the Piaget concept of cognitive disequilibrium. That's the psychological way to explain that particular phenomena. And it is. You tear something down, you have to encounter something you didn't expect. You have to encounter something that shatters the way you thought things should be. And that creates the potential for you to restore the equilibrium. You have to find a way to come to terms with that. Sometimes coming to terms with that means tear it down and start again. But other times it means give up. You know, and again, faith is the choice not to give up.
It's the choice to rebuild.
Exactly.
Maybe to find new temples of meaning or build new temples of meaning.
Which are, you know, bigger or better, stronger because they accommodate this larger worldview that's now been informed by this experience, which may not have been a great experience. One of our most prominent modern theologians, Jürgen Moltmann, has written a book called The Crucified God, in which he wants to argue that God intimately understands our suffering because God himself experienced that suffering on the cross in its fullest measure. And so I'm going to close with a quote from that book. And it's a little bit lengthy, but I think it's worth the read. And he says, "When God becomes man in Jesus of Nazareth, he not only enters into the finitude of man, but in his death on the cross also enters into the situation of man's God-forsakenness. In Jesus, he does not die the natural death of a finite being, but the violent death of a criminal on the cross, the death of complete abandonment by God. The suffering in the Passion of Jesus is abandonment, rejection by God, his Father. God does not become a religion so that man participates in him by corresponding religious thoughts and feelings. God does not become a law so that man participates in him through obedience to a law. God does not become an ideal so that man achieves community with him through constant striving. He humbles himself and takes upon himself the eternal death of the godless and the forsaken, so that all the godless and the forsaken can experience communion with him. May we give thanks for a God who loves us enough to suffer as we do. Thank you all for this conversation.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Thanks.
Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.